Welcome to the Grid Talk podcast. My name is Ruby Price, and today we're previewing the first Chinese Grand Prix weekend since 2019 as Formula One returns to the Shanghai International Circuit this weekend. Joining me today, we have Grid Talk co-host Sir Wayne Medford.
Hello.
And George Howson.
Afternoon.
And from AHGP, it's Aaron Harper.
Hello.
Before we go any further, we must thank our sponsor for this episode, Bet Online. Bet Online is your number one source for all your betting needs. Get the latest odds, lines, and matchup reports for baseball, boxing, golf, and more. Bet Online continues to be the fastest and easiest way to place your wagers, including live betting and your favorite casino and card games available to play right from your phone. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and get in on the action. Remember to use the promo code BELIEVE, that's BLEAV, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet Online, where the game starts. And where we're going to start, George, is with some contract talk. The big news this week being that Fernando Alonso re-signing with Aston Martin, which will see the Spaniard stay with the team until 2026. He'll be 45 years old. If he can make it to 2039, he will be the oldest driver to start an F1 race, but I don't think it's going to go that far, but hey, he's still around at this point.
He absolutely is, yeah. And, you know, he'll become the... if he sees out his contract to become the oldest Formula One driver since Graham Hill back in the 70s. So it's just Alonso, though. You know, he just keeps on going. He just keeps on continuing. You know, there's that old saying that, you know, if you're good enough, you're old enough. If you're good enough, you're young enough as well. And Alonso's proving that. You know, that's put a lot... You know, that's obviously put to bed a lot of the rumours about him maybe going to Red Bull or Mercedes or something like that. He's sticking with Aston Martin, which... obviously will make the Strolls very happy. And I expect that, obviously, Lance Stroll will probably partner him as well. I mean, it's not confirmed, but let's be honest here. It's probably going to happen at some point. They'll just sneak that one in there. But yeah, like we were talking before the show as well, there is a lot of seats still undecided. I mean, and the big one, obviously, is figuring out where Carlos Sainz is going to go. And for my money, as things stand, he's probably going to go to Mercedes, as I believe the Italian press has reported as well. But yeah, it's silly season. It's kicked off early, just like we've obviously had the calendar kicking off early as well for next year, that being confirmed, but we'll cover that later in the show.
Yeah, I mean, we thought silly season had kicked off early before the season started when we had Hamilton to Ferrari contract announcements from the Italian media, nonetheless. But Aaron, obviously, George has alluded to this, Carlos Sainz still without a contract, and it's looking like Mercedes, but apparently Mercedes want to leave an option open for Kimi Antonelli, or potentially Frederick Vesti?
I doubt Fred Vesti's really in the running for the seat. I mean, if Mercedes are going to put Kimi Antonelli in the car, they'll need to do it now. Because if they think that highly of him, why wait? You're not throwing him straight into a title fight that he might not be quite ready for. They've got a little bit of time because basically they've fluffed up these regulations 3 years in a row now. They can't seem to get the car on track and performing as it should be. So, I mean, they could get Carlos Sainz, but honestly, I expect Sainz to go back to the Red Bull family. I think he will go to partner Max Verstappen. I think Perez is reasonably good enough at Red Bull, but while they've got an advantage, he's able to sort of fit into that gap and finish on the podium enough, at least at the moment. We saw last year his form fell apart. But for me, I'm going to disagree with George. I think Carlos Sainz is going to end up back at the Red Bull family and in a front-running car, maybe giving Max Verstappen a hard time. I can't see Mercedes going for Sainz, giving him a one-year deal, knowing that they've got this really highly rated youngster that they really want to put in the car and cornering themselves. It would just cause even more hassle. What's the point in signing Sainz for one season? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, definitely. And Owen, Aaron thinks that Carlos Sainz are going to the Red Bull family. Speaking of Red Bull family drivers, obviously this sort of makes Tsunoda's drive even more precarious, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah. My thinking about it is that, I mean, it's a tale as old as time, really. If you've got an engine supplier and you're from a certain country and you haven't really got that many Grand Prix drivers from said country in the sport, you might maybe have some stipulation. So that I believe that there's a stipulation or at least some heavy pressure from Honda to have a Japanese driver somewhere in the Red Bull fraternity. So as it happens, that's Yuki Tsunoda. But of course, we have to remember that Aston Martin will be using Honda power units from 2026, replacing Mercedes. Now, given that the deal says that obviously Fernando Alonso will be staying at Aston Martin. And let's be honest, it seems ridiculous to see Stroll moving anywhere else by that point. Then there's not really sort of there's just not space. There's not space for Tsunoda in the sport anymore. And I don't think, to be honest with you, if Carlos Sainz were to move in anywhere at the Red Bull family or anything like that, you know, I don't think they really want to stick with him too long term. You know, that might just tip the scales away from Tsunoda sort of being able to have a drive, which would be a shame because it's to see an end to his career. And he's actually been performing very, very well, even better than Daniel Ricciardo of recent.
Yeah, absolutely. And George, speaking of Daniel Ricciardo, obviously not had the best of starts to the season, it can certainly be said. Obviously, the last time we were in China, Daniel Ricciardo was still considered one of the best drivers on the grid because he was in Renault in 2019. Is it just a case of he needs to get some momentum this season, or is it potentially just that Daniel Ricciardo maybe isn't suited anymore to this era of F1?
It's a really tough one to answer. I mean, obviously, Ricciardo is an immensely talented driver. We've seen that. He's the only guy that took that Red Bull to challenge the Mercedes back in 2014 in his first season, beat Vettel in the same car, in the same team that, you know, Vettel won four world championships back-to-back in. He's won in a relatively average McLaren. It was obviously pretty dire for the rest of the season, but he still managed that. You know, and he challenged Max Verstappen as well at Red Bull as well. So he is a very talented driver. I think the problem for Ricciardo is that potentially this car just suits Tsunoda some more. I think Tsunoda has took a step up as well. I don't think that should be underestimated. You know, looking at the championship at the moment, Tsunoda's the only reason why that RB team is looking like the favourites for sixth, which is realistically the best they can do because that top five is just miles ahead of the rest. So I think there's also a motivation factor to it as well, because realistically, looking at Ricciardo, the only step up for him as a driver now is to win the world championship. He's won races, he's got podiums, he's got really famous, he's done whatever he wants to do in the sport. The only thing that's left is winning the world championship. And he's not going to do that in an RB. He's only going to do that in a top team like a Mercedes, a Ferrari, or a senior Red Bull drive. And with a possible slight exception of the senior Red Bull drive, that's never going to happen. He's never going to get them seats. So I think with the greatest of respect, and this is not a slight against him, I've just said I'm a big fan, he's very talented, but it's just not the right team for him to be in. That RB team exists to be the junior team for Red Bull. That's why Tsunoda's in that seat. He wants to be a Red Bull driver one day. That's why Lawson was in that seat. He wants to be a Red Bull driver one day. Does Ricciardo want to go back to Red Bull and be beating all ends up every weekend by Max Verstappen? No. Why would he? So I personally think it's probably the time for Ricciardo to go. And like I said, there's no disrespect against him. I just think it's a situation. But he does need a good result. China has been a good track for him over the years. He won here in 2018. So there is that possibility. But with the former Tsunoda right now, it's looking tough for him to challenge for points, realistically.
Yeah, definitely. Very much the ball is in Tsunoda's court in terms of the better of the two RB cars. But Aaron, just the last thing on this sort of contract talk then. The two Ferrari customer teams both have their drivers' contracts up at the end of the season. Obviously, Bottas and Zhou populating Sauber at the minute. Magnussen and Hülkenberg populating Haas. Do you think either team is giving any indication that either of those drivers would be sticking around next season? And is there any benefit to dropping either of the drivers?
I think they're going to keep their cards close to their chest right now. Although I think Haas, it's very, very likely that Oliver Bearman will step up from Formula 2. He showed in his outing with Ferrari in Jeddah that he's got the minerals, as the word on the street says. He's got what it takes to be a top-line F1 driver. And to be honest, you could put him in a Ferrari next season, he'd do a very good job. I mean, this Lewis Hamilton bloke, he's a bit washed, isn't he, at the moment? So why sign him? But I digress. I think what Haas are probably doing is assessing which of their two experienced drivers is best to take forward, Hülkenberg or Magnussen. And at the moment, both are performing reasonably well. Hülkenberg's getting the better results. He's got a few points in Jeddah, of course, thanks to Magnussen's help, actually. With Sauber, they keep changing their name. I have no idea what they're called anymore. I'm just going to call them Sauber. So it's a little bit more tricky for them because they've got the situation with Zhou. They've got Teo Porcher waiting in the wings, who really does need to get a drive in 2025, or he'll go somewhere else because that kid's too good to sit on the sidelines. It's very much an Oscar Piastri waiting room situation. I'm just sure it'll just come without the dramatic tweets that we had with Piastri way back when. Does Bottas stick around? Maybe. I mean, he's doing okay. The car isn't fantastic. Zhou, where does he end up? He's not a terrible F1 driver, but there's certainly better options. But then there's this whole Audi situation. They're going to become Audi in 2026. So do they try and get someone in? And one of the top line stars, Carlos Sainz. But who's going to want to waste a season running around at the back in the half expectation that Audi hit the ground running? It's a weird situation, really difficult driver situation, sort of dynamic there. Honestly, you probably, if you're Audi, your best bet is to stick with Bottas, an experienced hand, and have Porsche as your young charger who's going to push Bottas to be better and then hopefully take the mantle. And if when Audi turn up, they want a big name, they can go and spend the big bucks and get one. But as for 2025, I think we can expect to see a change at both teams. So, yeah, I think there will be at least two changes of seat across those teams.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's certainly one person on this podcast who thinks that Audi are going to arrive in F1, hitting the ground running, and, you know, are going to dominate within seasons. But I just can't see Valtteri Bottas being the driver to be doing that. But, you know, it's a circuit that he's enjoyed that we're heading to. So, you know, we're returning to China. What comes to mind, Owen, when you think of the Chinese Grand Prix?
The most boring 1,000th Grand Prix that we've seen. Obviously, we've only had one of those, but I mostly wanted just to crowbar in the point that it's been 105 races since we last had a Grand Prix in China, and usually it's a classic. I think we got sort of shortchanged that long time ago, but it's a good track. I don't know how whether it'll suit this era of car, to be quite honest with you, but also I think that's going to be good because that means it's, you know what, the data is so old that everyone's got, you know, it's going to be, I think, a challenge for everybody. I think I'm expecting that Red Bull are obviously going to do well. You know, I don't think you can sort of neuter that car that much, but you know, it's usually an exciting race, and like I say, like the preparation that the teams will have, you know, they haven't got last year's data. They've got 5-year-old data. And one of the big things about the track over there is that, you know, it's built on sort of old recovered swampland. So it subsides and it moves about. You know, it's a similar issue that they have with COTA, except obviously they've, you know, not been there in four and a half, 5 years. So yeah, it's going to be a challenge, I think, for everybody. And I can't wait for it because I hope we get an exciting race out of that.
Yeah. George, what comes to your mind when you think of the Chinese Grand Prix?
Unfortunately, as a bit of a Hamilton fan, I get PTSD flashbacks to 2007, but that is a thing of the past now because that gravel trap is now tarmac. Yeah, I mean, there's that. I mean, we've had some good races. It's weird. It's a tilt-a-drum at the end of the day. It's from that generation of tracks, which for me, as a lot of people know, I'm not a big fan of in general, but There have been some good races around here. I remember 2013, the tyres absolutely were just not holding together at all. I mean, we had an amazing battle for, I think Vettel was trying to steam through and pass Alonso by the finish despite hitting like a few laps before. 2016 was absolute chaos at the start. That was the first of the two torpedoes from Daniel Kvyat on Sebastian Vettel. I think Alonso and Schumacher had a really good battle here back in 2006, I want to say. So there have been some good races here, and you know, and obviously we get some huge crowds there in China as well. And with it being the first in 5 years, you're going to expect it to be a sellout. You're going to expect it to be a big event, and it's the first Chinese Grand Prix this year as well that has a Chinese driver in it in Guan Yu Zhou. So that's what kind of comes to mind for me anyway when it comes to China. And I think as well the tires will be interesting. We kind of spoke before about how strategy and stuff was a challenge in Japan. I think it's going to be similar around China because anybody who's raced around this track in the F1 game, as I have many times, will know how hard it is to keep that front left tyre in a good condition because there are so many long right-handers. It's going to be a huge challenge. And for obviously, yes, the track will have changed. The data's all old and everything. And on top of that as well, we get one practice session because this is the first sprint weekend of the year. So I think even the experienced drivers, the ones who have been around here quite a few times, are going to be going into this relatively blind. So I'm hoping for a bit of unpredictability this weekend.
Unpredictability is absolutely, I think, on the cards this weekend. Aaron, what about you? What comes to mind when you think of the Chinese Grand Prix? Is there any candidates for the best Chinese race?
Absolutely. And picking up on your point of unpredictability, I would like to put forward the 2011 Chinese Grand Prix as possibly the blueprint for how Formula One should look, because you had the fastest car on pole position, but it didn't win the race and it was overtaken in the final stages. Mad strategy, tire wear, like George mentioned, was just all over the place. It was the first year of the original Pirellis where you showed them a racetrack and they died of fright. So Lewis Hamilton won the race, which won't surprise you. No bias here, of course, but he very almost didn't start that race. He had a fuel leak when they went to fire up his McLaren, and he had to go, basically he took the car half naked to the grid. The engine cover wasn't on. So people tuning in didn't have a clue until the commentators mentioned, oh yeah, Hamilton's had some problems pre-race. We're like, what? So they get off the line. It's crazy. Felipe Massa was winning the race at some point. Even Nico Rosberg nearly won the race. But Hamilton, from about half race distance, was fifth, came through to win the race. It was just so exciting all the way to the flag. And there were so many points where you didn't know who was going to win. It's exactly what the 22 regulations hoped to achieve. But it was all driven by tyre strategy, because the tyres were so fragile and it was so precarious on the strategy, whether it was a two-stop or a three-stop. And you had people making different decisions. And I think that's what we will see this weekend as well, is people doing different things because the data is so out of date. They don't have data for these tyres, these types of tyres, the low-profile tyres around China. One practice session. If you get it wrong, I mean, we don't actually know what they're going to do with the Parc Fermé yet. I haven't seen anything about that. So they might yet be able to escape. We might not have any Mercedes dramas where they've gone completely wrong on the setup again. So I think we're going to see a lot of unpredictability. And that 2011 race, if we get anything close to that, we're in for quite the Sunday morning, because that race was amazing.
In terms of Parc Fermé restrictions are brought into place from the sprint qualifying until the sprint race is done. And then there is a separate park, well, they open Parc Fermé before the qualifying for the race. So they at least get to do something with their learning from, you know, the mini race that they'll get to do beforehand. But Owain, leading for this, you know, we can't forget the fact that it is a sprint weekend, you know, and not only that, it's the new sprint format. One practice session on Friday, followed by sprint qualifying, a Saturday morning sprint at 4 a.m. UK time, which you'll be able to watch the Grid Talk reaction to live from 5:30 a.m. in the UK on our YouTube channel, for a quick cheeky plug. But of course, you know, it's the third iteration of the sprint weekend in three seasons. You know, how much of a difference will, you know, this lifting of Parc Fermé actually make?
Well, I mean, I hope it could go one of two ways. I mean, it could either sort of double down everything, or, you know, it could make things better in some ways. I can see it making the sprint more interesting, and the teams will go, you know what, we've got the ability to make, you know, change the sprint without, you know, without sort of locking ourselves in to a one tire style setup. So I can see that being positives, and teams being a bit further away from, you know, sorry, having a greater distance between the two setups. Otherwise, you know, it might go terribly in some ways, because we might end up with the sort of, with this scenario where the teams, you know, learn everything they can and, sorry, learn even more through the sprint, and then sort of, you know, generate a car that, with their learnings from both sprint qualifying and the sprint race, they'll have to do a lot of turnaround to do it, because they've only got 3 hours between the two. But they might be able to almost solidify the position even more and really lock that in, which, you know, would not be good for the race, obviously, overall. You know, I think unfortunately Formula One's got itself into this position where we've not got actually enough data points. That's why we've iterated so much over the sprint. But my hope is that we see a more interesting race because of it, and that, you know, teams can at least bridge those gaps and bring them closer by having these two setups that they can run.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, being able to make changes across the weekend, I think, will produce some interesting results, at least, you know, whilst, as you mentioned, some teams may use that extra data to further solidify their positions ahead, potentially they may already be that far ahead that it doesn't matter. But I think where this will have a big impact is potentially the midfield and maybe even those teams further at the back who, you know, hopefully, provided they survive the sprint and, you know, don't have to deal with damage, would at least be able to then get on the front foot. But George, speaking of teams, you know, worried a little bit about damage, a team who absolutely will be, you know, praying that their cars, you know, escape, you know, all of these competitive sessions with as little scratches as possible will be Williams. You know, we saw in Australia, Albon crash his own car and Logan Sargeant, you know, had to give up his chassis. In Japan, Albon didn't make it past the first sector, but fortunately for Logan Sargeant, the race had already started, so he at least got to finish this race. You know, how much pressure are Williams under, and is, you know, this organizational problem that they've like sort of had exposed, you know, more of just something that they're getting over, is now the turning point for Williams?
I hope it's a turning point for him, because it's not been a good start to the season. There is some pace in that car, but I do feel like they've lost out. They've lost out relatively to, well, especially the RBs and the Haas as well. I mean, the Haas has got points, and I don't believe the Williams has yet. So they're effectively, well, they're literally starting on zero this week, and still they're looking for their first points, and it's disappointing. It really is disappointing, but it's also tough because we've obviously got the budget cap in there, and maybe they kind of banked on them not needing that other chassis. I mean, I know where James Vowles has kind of come out in the media and said, you know, it's unacceptable this has happened, and, you know, we'll learn from this. But like has been touched on in a few of our shows previously, the fact that they were managing all the stock on Excel. I mean, I love Microsoft Excel. I live on that thing, but it is absolutely not. It's not the best option for that. It really isn't. So yeah, Williams, they'll be hoping it'll be a turning point for them. If I remember correctly, I'm testing my memory a bit here, I think Albon actually got his first F1 points round here back in 2019. So it can be quite a good track for them. At least him anyway. But yeah, Logan Sargeant, again, with the grace of respect to the guy, I'm not really expecting too much from him personally. But there is hope for Albon to do something, especially if they, you know, if they get really good strategy, if they qualify really well as well, especially for the sprint. I mean, that car historically has been very good in qualifying, not really so much this year, but if they get it up there and get a few places at the start, there's less time for them to lose out effectively in the sprint. So I am hoping they get off the mark this weekend, but I still think it's a big ask for them.
Aaron, F1 teams used to show up to a race weekend with a third car, never mind a few spare parts. There's been talk of other teams not having spare chassis and stuff, and running the risk of, you know, potentially having to sacrifice one of their cars if something happens at a race weekend. Do you think F1 needs to mandate that teams should have to bring key spare parts, such as the chassis, the power unit, maybe a team principal to every race?
It's a tricky question to answer. It's a good question, and one I'm not really sure I'm going to be able to answer one way or the other, because you could say, oh yeah, everyone should have equal opportunity to compete. They should be able to bring a spare chassis to build up like they did in the old days with the T car. But then who gets preference on that? Obviously, if both drivers have damage, you have to prefer one over the other. We've seen that historically where Ferrari, basically the T car was always set up for Michael Schumacher. And then, you know, poor Eddie Irvine had to drive around in Schumacher's car, which probably wasn't too bad, to be fair. I think back to the 1999 Australian Grand Prix, where both Stewart cars caught fire on the grid and Johnny Herbert had to sit out the race because there was only one car left. So it has happened. Part of me is like, this is a responsibility of the team. This is Williams having their own separate problem. No one else should be forced to bring parts. Everyone takes spare parts just because they want to cover off their bases. I don't think it should be mandated. I think, you know, if Williams are left in that position, then they should be left, because obviously Williams were the team that this sort of debate has sparked from. If a team is left without a chassis for a driver, they have to make that hard decision as to whether who they pull out of the race, essentially, whether they penalise the driver that hasn't crashed or penalise the driver who has crashed. So it's a really tricky one to answer. And obviously there's the cost-saving measures as well. Personally, I think all teams should be compelled to bring a spare chassis if they have one, and they should have the T car there ready to go, so a driver can hop back in during a session, if that makes sense, because then, you know, they can get back up to speed and stuff like that. There's other things they could use it for as well. But with Williams, they've shot themselves in the foot. So it's a tricky one. It's a really interesting topic, and I think something that could definitely be explored in terms of mandating it. But I don't think that's necessary because all the teams would just take it anyway. It's probably more a case of how much they can take and what they are allowed to take, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And Wayne, do you have anything sort of further leading on from this sort of idea? Like, you know, obviously you were very vocal about Williams's decision in Australia because we were on the race review show together.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to come across as a kind of a bad person here, but I don't think they should mandate the set of parts that you need to take. I mean, I think there's a certain argument that, you know what, you're a Formula One team, you deal in risk. That's what you deal in. You know, that all Formula One teams deal in risk all the time. That's fundamentally how you do it. You run your engine, let's say 10 horsepower more powerful. You're running the risk that you're going to blow it up more quickly. You know, are we going to start mandating that, you know, teams have to have a certain power output they have to hit, and so their reliability is such that they can all finish the season? You know, I think Formula One is the pinnacle of motorsport, and that means that you take it right to the edge of what you can manage. I think what we're seeing a little bit here is publication bias of a weird amount. If we were to go back to 2009, so 15 years ago, let's say the Braun had had the same troubles with the spare parts that they required throughout the season. You know, they'd had crash damage in the early few races. We wouldn't have seen a world championship out of them, and we wouldn't have seen two world championships. I think there's a certain amount of, you know what, we can set the rules as much as we can, but we shouldn't tell the teams how to run a Formula One team. That's ultimately, you know, we provide the FIA should provide a framework, and, you know, it's ultimately going to come down to whether Formula One and Liberty want there to be a show. You know, we have a set minimum number of races for a calendar. Do we have a minimum number of competitors? That sort of thing. I believe we do. But I don't think we should tell the teams how to run a Formula One team, because that's going to differ by where you are, what your operations are, the philosophy of how you run your business. And as much as I've had a go at Williams for not doing that, I think Formula One teams, I think all the teams make the decision of, we can probably get away with that. We see this happen all the time, because if you can get away with making one fewer rear wing, well, then you can. That means that you can put the money that it takes to build that rear wing, the actual, you know, production time, and you could put that into making a higher spec rear wing or something else like that. I mean, it's all a trade off, and you have to decide. And I think that's as much a part of how you create a fast racing car with two drivers driving it, rather than that's as much as creating a fast racing car as making sure that you've got all the bits is. You know, it has to be all sides of it. So I don't think we should be mandating anything to the teams. I think you make the decisions you make and you live with them.
Yeah, a perfectly valid reverse perspective almost to Aaron's. But also, as you've obviously mentioned, you know, extra parts is extra money. Extra parts is extra freight. There's obviously, you know, a push from F1 to go as carbon neutral, I think, by 2030, I want to say. But yeah, George, we've sort of alluded to this a little bit with obviously the weekend structure and, you know, the sort of element of unknown that we're going to be dealing with. I want to talk about strategy, because obviously last time out in Japan, we did obviously get a first lap red flag, which will have thrown so many strategies out of the window. But, you know, so many teams did seem to get it wrong in Japan. Mercedes on their hards, Alpine as well. You know, Red Bull were very comfortable, but that's the story of the season. What do you think contributed to the strategy in Japan? And do you think it could have any repercussions in China this weekend?
Well, they kept mentioning during the broadcast that it was quite hot. I looked at the forecast. It didn't seem that hot by F1 standards, although I'm sure someone will potentially correct me on that one. I suppose people were kind of banking on there not being a red flag at the start of the race, because there normally isn't. That's potentially part of it. But they obviously thought that with their practice running that the hard tyres were the tyre to have, but it turns out they really weren't. They were rubbish. And historically, thinking back, I think the hard tyre, when there has been a dry race in normal conditions, I think the hard tyre has been quite a good one around Suzuka. Softer tyres seem to just get absolutely torn apart. And again, from memory, not that many people ran the soft tyre during the race, or at least not for very long. So it was, and you obviously have to use two compounds of tyres. The mediums were the ideal tyres. I think if teams could have run medium, and it been allowed, they would have done that because that tyre would just seem perfect around that track. Charles Leclerc in particular doing absolutely amazing job in that Ferrari, keeping his mediums as long as he did. So it's kind of a catch-22 situation. Like, what do? Do you run these tyres that aren't very fast but will last, or do you run these tyres that just won't last? You're obviously going to go for the ones that will last because you'll still make the end of the race. So there's that, and then there's also the fact that it's usually quite hard to overtake around Japan, but it didn't seem it. It didn't seem it. I don't know whether it's just the DRS being a little bit longer this year or the car's being better to overtake, but it was not particularly hard to overtake around Japan, which is good, of course. That's what we want. So I think there will be some repercussions from that. We've obviously mentioned that the data's all old from China. The tracks would have changed. And just to throw another curveball in there, I looked at the weather forecast, and it's meant to rain on Saturday. So if all the dry running they do in the practice session be completely useless, it'll have the added effect of clearing the track up for Sunday, so no one's going to have any grip. So going to be fun. Going to be very fun. So yeah, I think strategy-wise, if that happens, if the rain calls and the rain gods answer, like the forecast is saying, then yeah, we could have a very, very topsy-turvy race on Sunday.
No grip at what is already going to be a relatively increased green circuit, Aaron. Rain the great equaliser, but obviously, you know, strategy being, you know, reacting to that rain and making the right kind of strategy. And we did see in Japan, like, Charles was making the key decisions for Ferrari's strategy. And whilst Ferrari didn't exactly deliver a bad strategy, we obviously saw Carlos Sainz finishing where he did. You know, Ferrari aren't known for their key strategy moments. Do you think, you know, that they're going to at least be consistent this weekend? Might we see, you know, the usual stuff from Ferrari? Or do you think, you know, maybe with their drivers who are on a charge this season, one in particular obviously has a lot to prove. Do you think, you know, we're going to see a good Ferrari in China? Or is it just a toss of the coin?
Well, like you say, the rain can throw even the best teams off track. We've seen it before. Back in 2010, there was some alleged, well, they thought there was rain coming early on. So some of the top guys pitted, including Red Bull, and they all ended up way down the order. They needed a safety car in the middle of the race to get back into it before the rain really did arrive. So yeah, the rain could be a great leveler. And also, because it's quite a long track, if you get caught out in the wrong place at the wrong time, you've got a lot of ground to cover on tyres that might not be suitable for the conditions. So yeah, rain has thrown a spanner in the works in China for many a driver, not least Lewis Hamilton in 2007. But no team, no driver is immune from mistakes in the wet. And Ferrari, exactly that. You're not quite sure what you're going to get from them. They've got better with their strategies. I mean, they've shown that they are less memeable this year. Let's put it that way. There's still the classic "we are checking" phrase, but, you know, they seem to be a bit more on the ball. And I think that's Fred Vasseur's leadership and a bit of strength in terms of giving the people who are in charge of that confidence to go and execute the strategies. And, you know, we'll just deal with it, do a sensible strategy, and we'll move forward from there. Because if you've got a good car and you do a sensible strategy, you'll get a relatively good performance and result out of the car, everything being normal. But if there's rain, you have to think on your feet. So let's see what Ferrari can deliver. But by the same token, let's see what Mercedes can deliver. What can Red Bull deliver under a bit of pressure? Let's say they get caught out of the rains coming, they're halfway around the track. Are they going to pit immediately with both cars? Verstappen gets first preference, but you know what I mean. What if Perez is ahead? What if Verstappen slid off the circuit? What do they do then? It will throw up all these fascinating questions, and then Verstappen will probably still win at the end of it all.
Aaron, if Perez is ahead, you know he's doing another lap so that Verstappen can undercut. I say very tongue-in-cheek, but before we get on to some predictions for this weekend, if you are listening to this podcast, we'd love it if you could take 5 minutes to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're one of the 72% of people who aren't yet subscribed to our YouTube channel, please consider helping us out with a like and a subscribe. So, Owain, predictions for this weekend. Who's going to be on pole? What's your top three?
I'll be honest with you. As much as I've sort of, you know, said that, you know, the track's going to be all, you know, all different to the teams and things like that, I think it'd be silly to predict anyone other than Red Bull. The car and the team seem so in harmony, and they seem to understand how to get the best performance out of it. you know, I think it's just going to end up working for them. I can't see any other option really than, you know, sort of a Verstappen Perez 1-2, both on pole qualifying and then in the race.
And because I've just been reminded of it, who's your sprint winner prediction?
My sprint winner prediction. You know what? I think that Red Bull might work. I think they're going to be risk averse. So I think your best chance of sort of getting something out of it is going to be maybe the sprint. And I'm going to go with Oscar Piastri. I think McLaren might have a shot.
One of the few sprint winners to not be from a Red Bull or a Mercedes team. George, your pole position, your sprint winner, and your podium, please.
Well, I like that as a almost a bold prediction from Owain with Piastri for the sprint win. So you know what? I'm going to go with the other McLaren for the sprint win. I'm going to go with Lando Norris. The man needs to win something eventually. It has to happen, even if it's not an actual Grand Prix. So I'll go for him for that. Qualifying's obviously going to take place on the Saturday after the sprint, so that's going to be in the wet. I'll go with Charles Leclerc. I'll go with Charles Leclerc because he's got obviously a lot of poles over the years. The race, it's really hard to bet against Verstappen. As much as I want to, I'm not going to. I'll put Verstappen in first. I'll put the smooth operator Carlos Sainz in second. And third place, you know what? I'll throw in Fernando Alonso. Not really based on that much. He's had some good races in China, as he has a brand every track, but he's feeling very youthful and exuberant, no doubt, after his contract extension. So, yeah, that's my podium for that.
Celebrating his new contract with some champagne in China. Aaron, your predictions, please. Your pole position, your sprint win, and your podium for the Grand Prix.
I'm going to go Lando Norris for pole position on Saturday. I think I just feel like this is going to be a McLaren circuit. They did well in Japan, and their drivers are starting to come to the boil this season now. They're just warming to their task, I think. So expect something good from Lando this weekend. And obviously, he's done very well in the wet. Obviously, remember back to Spa 2021, that race really should have belonged to him, but he ended up in the barriers at Eau Rouge, sadly. A sprint winner, I'm going to go Max Verstappen, and then Verstappen's going to take victory in the Grand Prix ahead of Lando Norris and Charles Leclerc on the podium as well.
And Owain, thinking a bit more bold, something a bit, you know, off-piste, something not quite as odds on, you know, what's your bold prediction for the Chinese Grand Prix weekend?
You know what? I'm going to go with an RB to finish in the top five. There you go.
Well, I mean, we've had top 10 finishes, you know, maybe Mr. Consistent, you know, Yuki Tsunoda, he's going to pop up in the top five. Maybe we could have some craziness in China. George, your bold prediction, please, other than Lando Norris obviously being on the sprint winning top position.
Yeah, it's not quite the top step. I don't know if they actually got onto the podium for the sprint, but that is definitely a bold one. But you know what? I'll go for Zhou Guanyu to be the first, not only the first Chinese driver to compete in his home race, but I'm going to go for points, whether that's in the sprint, whether it's a top eight in that or a top 10 during the race. I'm going to go for him to score points because, yeah, Sauber have not had a good year so far.
Certainly not. Maybe it'll kick them into gear. You know, those stakes are getting pretty high. But Aaron, your bold prediction, please.
I was going to actually go with George's one of Zhou gets points to keep up the run of home drivers at their home race scoring points, because obviously Piastri scored points in Australia and Tsunoda scored points in Japan. But George has beaten me to the punch there, so I'm going to go with Lando Norris gets his maiden victory from the predicted pole position that he's going to get. So yeah, it all marries up nicely.
And if George is right about the sprint race, he's winning the sprint race as well. So it'll be a great weekend for McLaren and a great weekend for F1 fans as well.
We'll be all Lando dominance by then.
Absolutely. You know, Lando Norris and China dominance. You know, he's only done one Grand Prix here and he didn't even finish it. You know, next time he's going to win everything. But, you know, let's give the panelists a chance to do a bit of promotion. Owain, is there anything you want to plug?
I'd like to plug keeping up to date with our socials. The reason why is that, you know what, it's starting at, what, we're doing a sprint race preview, sprint race review at 5:30 a.m. Just in case anything happens, you want to keep up to date and sort of know whether you can go back to bed for 20 more minutes, just in case there's a red flag or something like that. And you can keep up to date with that, Grid Talk UK, on all of the social medias with the app.
Waking up for the Japanese Grand Prix to have a red flag on the first lap, pained me. But George,
that was the start of my villain arc. That
the start of your villain arc. George, where can people find more from you? What do you want to plug?
If you want to see some more from me, you can go over to Football Chronicle. That's football spelt the Spanish way, F-U-T-B-O-L. I've just put a new opinion piece out about the new profit and sustainability rules in the Premier League and how really they're not probably going to change that much, to be honest. But we live in hope with that. And you can also head over to F1 Chronicle as well, F1Chronicle.com, where I post some articles on there and also do some videos as well on the socials, YouTube, Facebook, MSN, Talk Now, which you've just added. So yeah, head over to all of those.
Did you just say MSN?
Yes, MSN. It's a huge news platform. I think it stands for something else these days, like Microsoft something news or something. So yeah, we got over 4,000 followers on there now, so it's going pretty well.
Well done.
And not a joke, and deadly serious, unlike you with your puns.
I was completely thrown off by the fact that MSN is still some, like, as a concept. But Aaron, AHGP, go on, give us the plug.
Well, it won't shock you to learn that AHGP is just my name with Grand Prix on the end. But yeah, my channel on YouTube is an F1 manager dedicated playing channel. We've just hit 1,000 subscribers. Ruby, you were involved in the 1,000 sub celebration stream where we streamed some F1 23 open lobbies for a little bit of fun. But we stream F1 Manager. We're currently taking McLaren with no upgrades until Austria through season, trying to beat their 2023 points tally. We're probably not going to do it, but we're having fun along the way. And I'm currently in the middle of a Let's Play series with Haas, where I can only use Formula 2 or GP2 champions to drive for me. So currently I've got Nico Hülkenberg and Felipe Drugovic at the wheel. And yes, I have got Nico Hülkenberg a podium.
Even he couldn't do that to himself. But if you want to hear more from me, you can find me on the Grid Talk backlog. But also, if you want to find me on the socials, it's at Rube001 on Instagram and Threads. But if you want to find more from Grid Talk, it's available on YouTube, where most race episodes are recorded live, as well as Amazon Fire, Spotify, Google Podcasts. Obviously, we'll soon be saying rest in peace too, but there will be YouTube and music, Apple Music, Verbal, and Pocket Cast. To search Formula One Grid Talk for our back catalogue of shows with previews and reactions to the race results. Please consider supporting the channel on Patreon so we can get mics, lights, and better recording equipment. And also make sure you subscribe to the first know when each new episode is released every week. We'll be back soon with plenty more F1 content, the Chinese Grand Prix, Sprint, and race reviews. Thank you very much for listening to the Grid Talk podcast, presented by Bet Online, and goodbye.